You're listening to TheBody.com's podcast coverage of CROI 2009, the 16th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Montreal, Canada, from February 8th through February 11th, 2009.
Hello and welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of TheBody.com. I'm here today with Dr. Joel Gallant. Dr. Gallant has been treating people with HIV since the beginning of the pandemic. He's also a leading HIV researcher and a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Dr. Gallant.
Thanks, Bonnie. Good to be here again.
I think we should say before we begin that at CROI is such a rich conference with so many tracks that your take on the highlights focuses on just one small part of the conference, studies on antiretroviral therapy strategies.
Yeah, there was a lot at this conference. There always is a lot at CROI. It's by far the most important of the HIV meetings. But it was interesting to note the relative absence of clinical trials on antiretroviral therapy. There was plenty of great stuff on prevention and complications and things like that, but I kind of wonder if the lack of clinical trial data, which is something we usually talk so much about at CROI, it signals sort of a window period where we're not going to be seeing a lot of new drug development and new studies.
There's some good news to that. It means we're sort of satisfied at this moment with where we are.
Yeah, I think clearly we're in a much better place than we've been in a long time, and most patients are doing great on treatment with the drugs we have. But, we all worry a little bit that the honeymoon will end and that in a few years we could have people with a lot of resistance to some of the newer drugs. And the concerning thing is if there's not a lot of drug development and we need new agents for those people, what's going to happen?
But isn't it true that there's less resistance seen in HIV-infected patients?
There is right now. However, I have to say that a lot of these drugs like Isentris just came out recently. I've seen a lot of misuse of some of these agents by less experienced clinicians. I've seen resistance developing already, and it's concerning because the same mistakes that we made in the 80s and 90s are still being made now in this decade, and with these newer drugs, we worry whether they'll continue to last for all patients.
Could you be more specific? What kind of mistakes are being made, do you think?
I'll give you an example of a patient who had very extensive drug resistance, had been treated for many years with lots of failing regimens, and his doctor put him on Truvada and Isentris. Of course, he was fully resistant to Truvada, so it was only a matter of months before he was fully resistant to Isentris. And that means he'll be resistant to other integrase inhibitors as well. It actually is a good segue to the SwitchMark study, which was presented at this conference, which really showed exactly that issue. I'll just jump ahead and talk about that study, and then that'll, I think, bring home my point. This was a study done by Merck looking at raltegravir or Isentris, the new integrase inhibitor. They took patients who were on a Kaletra-based regimen and doing well, and randomized them to either continue Kaletra or to switch to Isentris. The problem with the study, and this is what led to Isentris not performing well in the study, was that they allowed pretty much anybody into the study, regardless of how much resistance they had, how many prior regimens they had failed. There were some people who got into the study who had been treated for 22 years with antiretrovirals, so that dates back to the AZT monotherapy era, and who had been on as many as 16 different antiretroviral agents. So the fact that they were doing well on just Kaletra and some nukes was surprising, but to expect them to do equally well by switching to Isentris is naive. We know that boosted protease inhibitors have a much stronger barrier against resistance than integrase inhibitors, so they were essentially taking Kaletra monotherapy for all intents and purposes, and then by switching to Isentris monotherapy, they failed because it's easier to become resistant to an integrase inhibitor. Most expert clinicians would have known better than to do this to a patient. I'm sure that same thing is happening in clinical practice as well, this belief that these new drugs are so great that you can do anything with them. I don't mean to paint a bleak picture. Obviously, most people are doing great, but it's so important when using these new drugs to really be using them wisely and carefully, and not just assuming that any use of them will be fine.
I noticed there were no new drugs presented, or very few. I was looking for Vicrovirok, and I didn't see that.
There was a little bit about elvitegravir, but it was in the context of the new Gilead booster.
That's going to be, hopefully, a new four-in-one drug?
Well, yeah. There was quite a surprise in the audience when Gilead announced that they had already co-formulated a four-drug combination containing all four Gilead drugs. So it had the equivalent of Truvada, which is tenofovir and FTC. Then it had the L-Vitegravir, which is their new investigational integrase inhibitor. And then it had GS-9350, which is a drug that they are developing to replace Norvir as a booster. We use Norvir or Ritonavir pretty much only for its ability to boost levels of other drugs. L-Vitegravir needs a booster. Obviously, drug companies don't want to go out with a new drug that's dependent on Ritonavir, and they want to be able to co-formulate. So they are developing this booster in tandem with L-Vitegravir. What this does, in addition to allowing co-formulation, is it allows them to study this drug in treatment-naive patients. Because if they have to use Ritonavir, they're not going to be allowed by the FDA to study it in naive patients because the FDA is concerned that you don't want to give low-dose Ritonavir in a patient who's not taking a protease inhibitor because it might create resistance. So that was leaving them stuck within a treatment-experienced patient population and a head-to-head comparison with Raltegravir, which just seemed like it was not likely to go quickly or well. Now they can study this head-to-head, this four-drug pill, in comparison with Atripla, the three-drug combination, in naive patients, and it could lead to a much more rapid development of both of the drugs.
And the booster will be used separately for a lot of other reasons.
There'll be two purposes. One will be in co-formulation with L-Vitegravir as a booster for L-Vitegravir. Gilead says it will be a standalone product that can be used to boost other protease inhibitors. I think they'll be doing some studies looking at their booster, boosting other PIs, but then, of course, some of the other companies, especially BMS and Tibotec, would be probably interested in potentially using it with Prozista and Reataz, and not to mention lots of other drugs, including drugs outside of the HIV field that might be boostable with a drug like this.
And it has no activity against HIV.
And, of course, the hope is that it causes less gastrointestinal side effects and less lipid toxicity than Ritonavir, but all we have so far is very early data, but so far it looks like it's well tolerated.
Wasn't there another booster presented?
Yeah, Sequoia Pharmaceuticals, a very small company, has a booster that they're studying with protease inhibitors, and so far it looks like it's doing the job to boost those levels as well. My concern with that drug is that although, of course, they call it well tolerated, which is what all new drugs are always said to be, but seemed like there was quite a bit of nausea, headache, and vomiting in the study. So if they've got a booster that causes nausea, headache, and vomiting, even Ritonavir doesn't do all that. So we'll see what the tolerability profile looks like in further studies.
Anything else that you saw about new entrant vials?
Everything else was sort of in very early phases of development. There was a study about Pro-140, which is this monoclonal antibody that's used by infusion. That was presented, although I didn't really get anything out of the presentation that was newer than what we've heard before. But most of the new drug presentations were very early stages of development, and I sort of gloss over those.
There was no new news on Vicrovirok yet.
The thing to remember about Vicrovirok is that although it's a once-a-day CCR5 inhibitor that's boostable with Ritonavir or some other booster, other than that, it doesn't have a lot of advantages over the existing CCR5 inhibitor, Maraviroc, or Celcentri. And Maraviroc is not exactly a big seller. There's not a whole lot of people taking it. And so it kind of calls to question what is the future role of these drugs. And most of the reasons for their lack of use are not because of problems with the drugs themselves, but because of the need for the expensive trophil assay first. So there are a lot of CCR5 inhibitors in development, but it seems like it's a pretty small market right now.
So on to what looks like the new focus of these kind of conferences, which are adverse effects of HIV. And there were a lot of data about cardiovascular issues. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so there was a lot of attention trying to further understand this possible connection between abacavir and heart attack or cardiovascular risk. Up until this conference, we had the DAD study that showed a risk, the SMART study that showed a risk, and then we had the GSK analysis of their data that did not show a risk. So we've got some more information from this meeting. First, there was more presentation from the DAD. They now have enough data on tenofovir to look at the risk with tenofovir, and they did not find a risk with tenofovir. And they have argued that this strongly suggests that the abacavir risk that they're seeing is not what we call a channeling bias. That is to say that people who are at high risk of heart disease would be put on abacavir preferentially, and therefore it would make abacavir look like it was associated with risk. The argument is that had that been true, they should have seen the same thing with tenofovir, and they did not. That argument has got its problems, but I think they've demonstrated in many other ways that channeling bias does not appear to be a big issue here. They, in this study, also looked at risk with protease inhibitors. Of course, we've always known, especially from the DAD study in the past, that protease inhibitors have been associated with an increased risk of heart disease. They've helped further define that and showed that indinavir or crixivan, which we rarely use anymore, is associated with a higher risk, as is Kaletra. And what was interesting was that the risk in the case of indinavir was not associated with the use of ritonavir. In other words, you couldn't explain the increased risk of heart disease based on whether or not people were boosting indinavir with ritonavir. And also that the risk with indinavir and Kaletra was not dependent on their effect on lipids. It was an independent risk, which was interesting.
What does that mean?
A lot of people have just assumed that the protease inhibitors increase heart disease risk because they increase cholesterol. And if you control the cholesterol, you'll eliminate the risk with protease inhibitors. The DAD study suggested that while cholesterol is part of the problem, it may not be the only problem, and that there may be an independent association that's not just explained by cholesterol effects. I'm not trying to say that this is established fact now. This is an observational study, but that is what they found.
Something in the medication?
Yeah, or for example, indinavir is well known to cause insulin resistance and affect glucose metabolism, and that could affect heart disease risk. That is not as true with Kaletra as it is with indinavir, but there may be some role there. Of course, the problem is that they don't yet have data on the PIs that we're using most commonly, namely Reataz and Prezista. So we've kind of assumed that those drugs may be a little bit safer, but we don't have data from the DAD study yet on those two. There was a new study from the French National Hospital Database. It's a case-control study where they, again, found a risk associated with abacavir for risk of myocardial infarction. In this study, the heart attacks were confirmed by cardiologists, so it was well done in that way. But what they found when they did their first pass at the data, they did not find a risk. Where they found a risk was when they did sort of a post hoc analysis looking specifically at patients who have taken abacavir recently, that is within the last 6 months, and during the first year of abacavir therapy. So they're finding kind of consistent with DAD that it's early and active use of abacavir that is associated with a risk, not cumulative risk as you would see with a protease inhibitor, but this sort of on-off phenomenon that was described with DAD. A different kind of a risk than with a protease inhibitor. And people have argued, well, that probably suggests that the risk with abacavir is not a metabolic risk. It's not from increased cholesterol and buildup of plaque in your coronary arteries, but if anything, it could be some kind of a risk due to inflammation that occurs while you're on it and then goes away when you stop. That's certainly a logical explanation, except that the data on looking for this inflammatory process have been kind of inconsistent, with some studies showing something and some not showing it. There's been a couple other studies at this conference. One was the STEEL study from Australia. It was a randomized trial comparing people who switched to Epsicom, or Cavexa as they call it there, versus switching to Truvada once they were suppressed, and found 8 cardiovascular events in those who switched to Epsicom versus 1 among the Truvada patients, and that was a significant difference. It's noteworthy that these were not all heart attacks, though. There was kind of a mishmash of heart events. Finally, there was a study looking at a variety of ACTG studies with long-term follow-up on abacavir that showed no risk of MI. So, as Peter Rice pointed out in a really nice review of this subject, the score is now 4-2. 4 studies showing an increased risk, and 2 not showing an increased risk. He pointed out, first of all, that the studies that don't show a risk, the average patient age is about 7 to 10 years younger than in the studies that do show a risk. And of course, age is a risk for heart disease, so you could argue that it's going to only be in older people that you're going to see a significant difference. He also made the point that I thought was interesting, that the studies that show a risk tend to have more people who were already suppressed when they started abacavir. Their viral load was undetectable. Whereas the studies that don't show a risk, everybody had a detectable viral load before starting abacavir. The reason why that could be important is that when you treat anybody for HIV with any combination, you're going to see an immediate decline in risk because all this inflammation and immune activation and risk of clotting, all of these things decrease dramatically when you start antiretroviral therapy. So what he said was that if you had minor differences between drug A and drug B, you wouldn't really see them in a study that looked at suppressing patients who were naive, because any difference between the drugs would be completely overwhelmed by the benefit you were getting from treatment. And that it's only in studying people who are already on treatment and then go on abacavir versus another drug that you're going to see a difference, because it's a much more subtle difference. It's an interesting hypothesis that deserves to be looked at further.
It's an interesting theory. It just seems counterintuitive, I guess, that someone suppressed would be more at risk for heart disease.
Remember, they're not more at risk than if they weren't suppressed. They're clearly at lower risk than if they weren't suppressed. But there may be a difference between drug A and drug B once you're suppressed.
What does all this mean to the clinic and to a patient today?
Yeah, I think the current DHHS guidelines have it right. I think they say that for patients who have no risk factors for anything, then Truvada is the best nucleoside backbone to use. But there are patients who are not good candidates for Truvada, mostly people who have got kidney issues. And for those people, Epsicom may be the appropriate choice in many cases. I think Epsicom is the most appropriate nucleoside backbone for people who have kidney issues but don't have high risk for heart disease. The problem we get into is the people who have both. And so, for example, a diabetic with high blood pressure is at risk for both kidney disease and heart disease. So what do you do with that person? This may be where we start getting into nucleoside sparing options, but very few of those have been well studied, and we have not studied them for this particular population. But that's kind of what a lot of us are doing for people who are not good candidates for either tenofovir or abacavir. But I would just stress again that I don't worry much about abacavir in people who have no significant cardiovascular risk, but it's the people who smoke and have a family history of heart disease or diabetes or high blood pressure and have multiple risk factors that I would worry.
And do you think a lot of people are doing a lot more risk assessments in terms of cardiovascular health of their patients?
I hope so. I hope that was happening even before the abacavir issue, because we know that people with HIV are at higher risk for heart disease, that drugs like protease inhibitors and to some degree efavirenz can increase the risk. And, of course, a lot of us are doing some degree of primary care anyway, and our patients are getting older. We should be looking at this just from a primary care angle. So I think this only increases the importance of using the online calculators, calculating Framingham risk, and talking to patients, especially about modifying the correctable risk factors. I'm sure that if you were to have a choice between smoking cessation versus switching from abacavir to another agent, you'd get much, much more benefit from smoking cessation. The benefit you might get out of abacavir switch would be much more modest. So it's really important for us all to be trying to correct the risk factors that we can correct.
Have you seen, as a result of this news being disseminated, a lot of patients coming in frightened and not really knowing what they could do to reduce their risk?
Most of them know, because we're talking about diet, exercise, and smoking cessation, and it would be an unusual patient who hadn't been told a few times by a doctor about that kind of thing. But it never hurts to talk about it again. With any substance abuse counseling or smoking cessation counseling, people eventually may get it, and it may take 20 conversations. The 21st is the one that does it, but we should never give up.
Okay. Is there anything I missed here?
I think a big study was the NA Accord study about when to start. That was a very important one. There were two trials presented back-to-back. One was NA Accord. This is a big observational study in North America, combining data from lots of different centers. I think you and I had talked after ICAC and IDSA about their first study that compared people who started therapy with CD4s between 350 and 500 versus those who waited until after their CD4 was below 350 and found a 70% better survival in those who started early. At CROI, they presented the same kind of analysis, but now they looked at people who started above 500 versus those who waited, and they found a 60% improvement in survival. Now, keep in mind that most of the people who started above 500, that was back in 1998, because that was when people were doing the hit early, hit hard, and in their cohort has been a lot fewer people in the more recent years who have done that. And yet, even with the drugs available in 1998, which were difficult, toxic combinations, they still found this survival benefit. So if they're right, then the benefit would even be greater today than it was back then. There's all sorts of potential problems in a study like this. The main one is, could there be what's called an unmeasured confounder, which means that, let's say that the reason some people started early was because they were highly motivated, well-informed, health-seeking type people who were eager to treat their HIV as aggressively as possible, and at the same time that those same behavior and characteristics also caused them to eat right, exercise, not use illicit drugs, not drink to excess, not smoke. In other words, they were doing all sorts of things that improved their survival. So the very same factor that could affect their decision to treat would also affect the endpoint, and that's what we call a confounder. Now, if that were true, that could invalidate the results of the study. However, the investigators, who are well aware of this potential pitfall, have done as much as they can to try to control for that, but they point out that for a confounder to invalidate their results, it would have to be a very, very large confounder, and they showed data to support that. They also pointed out that people in the group that waited tended to do as well virologically as people who started early. They tended to have the same rate of suppression. So it's a very strong, powerful study, but it is not a randomized trial. And we're going to have to wait and see what people think about whether this is enough to change the way we treat or whether we need to go ahead with a trial. The other study was from the ART Cohort Collaborative, another large conglomeration of cohorts. And they presented data that, again, showed that it's better to start at CD4s above 350 than below 350. They, however, did not find a benefit when you started to get up above 500. Their methods are a little different. They don't have data on what happened to people before they started therapy. They had to kind of, what they call, impute that information from older historical studies.
What does that mean?
Well, it means they take cohorts from the pre-HART era and look at prognosis at various CD4 counts and estimate that in their population of people who waited up to a certain point to start therapy, that those same data would apply to them. It's a way of trying to reduce what's called lead time bias, which means that if you have people starting at different time points, but you don't have the data that led up to what happened to them while they were waiting to start, then you could be missing things. For example, somebody who starts at 200 versus somebody who starts at 350, how do you know there weren't people who died while they were waiting to start to 200 and you don't have that data? The advantage of the NA Accord study is they do have the data. They can look at everybody from the same CD4 point, whereas in the ART Cohort Collaborative, they had to impute that from other sources. They're both perfectly acceptable techniques in statistics, but you could argue that having the data is better than having to guess at the data.
But do you think we still need to spend millions of dollars to discover the answer to this in a randomized study?
I don't think so. I have to say that, and others have made this point before me, when you think about what we're really arguing about, it's kind of angels dancing on the head of the pin. We all agree now, I think, that we should be starting before you get to 350. If we're going to argue about 500 versus 350, that sounds like a big difference. But really, when you're thinking about it in terms of how long it takes the average person to get from 500 to 350, we're talking about a year or two. Now, put that into the context of a person's lifetime. Say you're a 25-year-old with a CD4 of 500, and you're looking at being on treatment, hopefully, for 30, 40 years or more. Do you start at 500 or do you start at 350? Well, that's 1 or 2 years out of, say, 40 years of treatment. Is that really an important thing to figure out? I mean, it certainly has cost implications, but from a medical point of view, it just doesn't seem all that important to me. And the other thing that I think is that we're at the point now where we've got this disease that's quite easily treatable with very effective treatment. You know, I'm trying to think of some other infectious disease where you would have to prove that it was okay to treat. HIV is unique in that the burden of proof seems to rest on those who want to treat early. Whereas for another infectious disease, you'd say, show me that I can wait. Show me that it's safe to wait. The reason for that is historical. It's not medical. It's because first we didn't have treatment, then we had lousy, ineffective treatment, then we sort of had lousy, effective treatment, and now we have good, effective treatment. And because it's gone in that direction, we've kind of approached it from the opposite direction, where the default is not to treat, and what you have to prove is a reason to treat. I just think the data, not just these studies, but more and more data showing that from the moment you're infected, your body is in a state of inflammation, immune activation. No matter how high your CD4 count is, it is not normal or healthy to have HIV in your blood. My own feeling is that for people who are highly motivated and who are highly confident in their ability to adhere to therapy, it probably makes sense to treat at any time. The question is when you have people who may not be good at taking therapy. We certainly don't want to see people developing resistance when their CD4 is still 500. That would be a bad thing. So we have to be a little careful about not applying these ideas across the board. But I certainly, if you ask the average HIV expert, what would you do if you were positive? I can tell you they all say, I would start treatment immediately. I always tell patients the most important thing you can ask a doctor is, what would you do if you were in my position, or if it was your son or daughter or something like that? It's a useful question to ask a doctor, because a lot of times doctors are afraid to give an opinion that is clearly an opinion and not based on solid data, but it's sometimes useful to know what they really think down deep.
But isn't this question kind of moot? Most people in the United States get diagnosed at a CD4 count of around 260.
And that's another reason why I worry about the feasibility of the trial. It relies on being able to enroll thousands of people with CD4s above 500. And not only that, but people who are willing to be randomized to what they might consider treatment too early, or they might consider treatment too late. So I worry that it's going to be hard to enroll this study. I'm hoping that if we start following CDC recommendations and making HIV testing a routine matter where everybody's getting tested, that we will start to diagnose people at higher CD4 counts, and this will become an important question. But at the moment, you're absolutely right. Most people, by the time they are diagnosed, already meet unequivocal indications for therapy, and there's no debate about whether they should be treated.
I guess one final note, the trial that is being thought of is the START trial, right?
Well, it's been funded. I don't think it's enrolling at this point.
So it seems like it's going through.
I don't know. There's a lot of pushback about this, and these difficult economic times, I think a lot of us are questioning whether this is the best way to spend NIH money. But there are certainly a lot of people who are wanting to see this trial go forward, and who would argue, and rightly so, that the data that we have so far are just not convincing enough for them, and that we need a randomized trial. The great danger, of course, is that when you plan a trial that takes this long, you could end up 6 years from now with either results that don't matter to anyone anymore because they've kind of moved on to a new question, or you could find yourself midway through the study with nobody being willing to enroll because treatment standards have just evolved during that time period, and I think that's a big concern.
So is there anything at the conference that surprised you?
I think I was the most surprised by the fact that Gilead had this quadruple co-formulation already made before we'd even heard any data on the drug. So that was impressive.
So thank you very much for, once again, a very good update, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Bonnie, thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thanks for listening to this report from CROI 2009. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebody.com/CROI2009.